Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you as usual live from the Midtown Atlanta studios, Georgia Public Broadcasting, broadcasting across the great state of Georgia again this afternoon. I want to welcome to the table, as always, my colleague Jim Galloway, the political writer of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his columns in the Dead Tree edition on Thursdays and Sundays. And he oversees the Political Insider blog on AJC.com. And his colleague, Aaron Gould-Shinen, is back with us again today. He's political reporter at AJC. And Aaron, of course, we love having you here because I don't think anybody at the paper is paying quite as much attention as you are to statewide races and other political happenings in the state right now. We'll talk about some of that today. Former Congressman Buddy Darden, Democrat from Cobb County. You remember, Buddy, when Cobb County used to be a Democratic area.
Long time ago.
And Brian Robinson, former Communications Director and Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Brian, now out in the government affairs world. Thank you for being here again, Brian. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Bill. So I prefer being introduced as a master of the dark art.
Okay, so to get started today, I want to make a public service announcement. We're going to start with some breaking news. There's a major new poll of Georgians in terms of their preferences in the presidential race from Public Policy Polling, which is a very reputable organization, and we're going to start with that. But here's my public service announcement. Jenny Ament has queued up and ready to go for later in the show some of the comments that Donald Trump made yesterday in his news conference about the media. And we debated whether or not we wanted to play them because they've been all over the airwaves for the last day. So we decided we're going to let you decide. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Let us know. Do you want to hear these comments again? We're going to talk about them anyway and Trump's ongoing love-hate relationship with the media. But tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Let us know whether we should play them or not. Okay, fair enough? All right. Yeah. Let's go to the PPP poll. And because this is a very fresh poll, I will just give a quick capsule summary of it. The lead, Jim Galloway, that they have put on their release of this poll is that Democrats who want to flip the state blue, state of Georgia blue, may have very little chance of doing that now that Republicans are beginning to unify around Donald Trump. They show him leading Hillary Clinton in Georgia 45-38. That's not surprising.
Well, 45-38, I would think if that's kind of the reflexive corner positions of the Democratic right. and Republican parties in Georgia. So basically what that means is that candidates don't matter. Well, candidates do matter, but it's the fear of the other candidate that matters.
Right.
And the hatred of the other candidate that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. If this poll is true, if that's really an accurate reflection of where we are today, then I've seen this number at this time of the year over and over and over again, and we're going to have a 53-47 election in Georgia. That is what this means. I've seen it 1,000 times over the last 6 years. And in this particular poll, as Aaron and I were just discussing, I think the Republican sample may be a little high, even though this is a Democrat-based poll. The previous polls I've seen, such as from Landmark, I felt like had too high of a Democrat tilt, and that one had it almost neck and neck with Trump up by one. I think the truth is probably somewhere in between, but Trump is ahead in Georgia, and you're seeing the Republican hierarchy and the rank and file falling into place behind the nominee as good party soldiers.
Buddy, the state Democratic Party about a week or so ago tried to put a pretty good spin on the potential to turn Georgia purple in this election cycle, but it doesn't really seem likely to happen, does it?
Well, that's the job of the party. However, you've got to realize here we are on June the 1st, and I would agree with Brian completely about if you look at past years. However, this is no usual year. I think everyone will agree that this thing is wide open, one of the most volatile elections we've ever had.
Here in Georgia?
I think in Georgia and nationwide.
Okay.
Nationwide.
Yeah, sure.
And I think anything can happen. So I think probably the poll is accurate. right now as of June the 1st, but who knows what's going to happen between now and November.
Aaron, let me drill down to a couple of other interesting numbers with you, if I may. PPP found that Newt remains, they call him decently popular. I've never quite heard that word applied by a pollster, but fine. He has a 44% to 36% favorability rating. But here's what's interesting. As Newt continues to try to sort of position himself with the media as a likely VP prospect, or certainly one of the big possibilities, they found that he actually hurts Trump in scenarios where he would be the running mate. It brings Trump's lead over either Clinton or Sanders down 5 points. So as well-liked as Newt is in terms of favorability in the poll, he doesn't help the ticket.
No, and I kind of wondered, like, there are a couple different things about that. Does Newt cost him some of the independent vote? Does some of the folks who might be considering Trump just can't deal with Newt for one reason or another? From a completely snarky standpoint, you've got six ex-wives among the two of them. That might be a lot for one ticket. I'm not sure. But they also, you know, Trump has talked a lot about needing somebody different than himself for his running mate, and I think there's a lot of similarities between Newt and Trump that might turn some people off, that the ticket would be too one-sided and without enough sort of inside Washington, current inside Washington experience.
Here's another interesting thing about that, Jim Galloway. They say that as we look at the crosstabs, undecided voters, if they see Gingrich as the running mate, they give Clinton a 20% bump against Trump in the
you're talking about probably the three politicians in the United States with the highest unfavorability ratings right there. And I'll take Aaron's
Dick Cheney. Maybe Hillary can pick Dick Cheney as her VP.
But if I'll take Aaron's side on this, Gingrich said something late last week that who's the U.S. Senator from Tennessee?
Bob Corker.
He said Bob Corker as a VP candidate would bring, he would be a very stable guy to put with Trump.
He said what you often look for, someone who contrasts with the presidential candidate, who brings something to the table, the presidential candidate.
Yeah, and if you are, to take his own advice, if you are trying to put somebody very stable next to Donald Trump, maybe you don't go with Newt Gingrich.
Because if you've got Gingrich there with him, you know, so you're going to close the borders, you're going to build a wall, and then you're going to build a moon colony on, right? You know.
All right, I do. Go ahead.
Wait a minute. We're leaving out another Georgian who has told a number of Republican political insiders that he wants to be considered and thinks he is in the running to be the vice president. And of course, we're talking about our own Senator David Perdue.
Do me a favor. Park that for a few minutes, because we are going to talk about Perdue, what may be his opening public salvo in looking for an opportunity to serve with Trump. But Brian Robinson, we're going to still talk poll for another minute. You okay with that?
Yes. That's
fine. Go ahead.
I think
I love that Brian raises his hand sometimes.
It's because I am the youngster here in this august body. One of the most interesting parts of the poll to me that I think is most important in Georgia is Georgia statewide elections are determined by independent voters. And the reason why all statewide elected officials in Georgia are Republican is because they lean heavily Republican. And in this poll,
those independent voters.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're independent-leaning Republican. They're Republican-leaning independents, rather. And that group in this poll is going with Trump. That is a huge indicator. I've seen polling in the past that showed that very competitive for Hillary. If it's competitive for Hillary, the state's competitive.
Right. That's what makes it a purple
state. And I think you also have a very conscious and cold, calculated decision by Georgia Republicans pretty much across the board. I mean, ranking Republicans pretty much across the board that they may not like Trump, but they're going to go with him.
Because they hate her. Very... I mean, the animosity toward her amongst my Republican colleagues is so deep and so toxic that I don't think there's anybody with an R behind their name they wouldn't vote for to vote against her.
Okay, Aaron, I want to drill down a little more because I think there's some more really interesting findings in this poll. First, you should know, in case you're thinking about writing this piece soon about Mark Cuban as a potential running mate, 60% of Georgians have no idea of who Mark Cuban is. They're obviously not watching Shark Tank. But
oh, see, I just know him as the Mavericks owner. I don't even watch Shark Tank.
Okay, but let's go down to some other figures that are really fascinating. Almost 50% of the people in Georgia who say they'll vote for Trump believe that Hillary Clinton had some involvement, buddy, in Vince Foster's death. That's chilling.
The scary thing about it is that this is a Bertha crowd all over again. This is a conspiracy group, and it's been proven over and over and over again how ridiculous and really how sick this kind of thought is, that people would even think that she would have anything to do with
all
Vince Foster.
And Aaron, 52% of Trump voters say they want the Confederate flag back on the state flag in some form or another.
Yeah, you know, I read something from a guy in North Carolina the other day about Trump and his effect with folks in the South in particular, that people that are supporting Donald Trump in a lot of ways feel like they've been losing for decades, and that Trump gives them the opportunity to win again, for whatever, you know, mindset you might put in that. And that plays back to the old flag and wanting it back to a time when they were maybe economically better off, where they thought they had a brighter future. But it's a remarkable result.
All right. Win what?
Yeah, win in life. Their point of view, and that's what I'm saying. This writer was trying to sum up the mindset of Trump supporters, especially in the South, is that, meaning white males, feeling that they have not been winning.
That's not hard to believe, is it, Jim?
No, that's not. I mean, just given what we know about Trump supporters, I mean, yeah, he's broadening that coalition, but his core supporters are high school educated white males. But if we could get back to the Vince Foster thing, now this is something that PPP does.
Yeah,
they do ask a lot of a little bit off the wall questions, and I think what that if you have 50% of voters don't know who the heck Vince Foster was.
Right, I think great point.
But they do know that they don't like Hillary. That's what we're getting back to. It's the animosity toward a particular candidate.
And they're willing to believe anything negative about her that comes up.
Yeah, the question could just easily have been, do you believe that Hillary Clinton would kill somebody? Mm-hmm. 52%, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, then let me close out this conversation about the poll, Jim Galloway, with, I thought, a fascinating statistic here, although you may take issue with how they do it. They asked a question, and I don't have the actual question. I've got it, but I can't find my crosstabs right now. Trump fans, they say, are pretty ambivalent on whether they even think it's a good thing the North won the Civil War. Only 37% say they're glad the North won, 31% the South, 32% they don't know.
Well, that's because it's not over yet.
Well, I mean, do you think that's a legitimate question, or do you think it's silliness?
I think it's a little bit of silliness.
Okay.
I truly do.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on this polling before we move on? Aaron?
My only thought, though, was that those three questions that you mentioned are more designed to paint a picture of the Trump supporters in a negative light.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
from
what
a Democratic polling firm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all those three questions are designed to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're a Republican, you're racist. That's what they want to say.
And a conspiracy theorist.
And a conspiracy theorist, yeah. And living in the past. And you are, this is all about your mourning of the loss of white privilege. That's their narrative. And these questions play into that.
Okay. Fair enough. Buddy Darden, you mentioned David Perdue. And I want to talk about Perdue's op-ed piece in today's Washington Post. Let me grab it here. Excuse me. Perdue wrote a piece for the Washington Post, which was headlined, Senator Perdue says Donald Trump proves it's time for an outsider. Republican voters have sent the Washington establishment a message in the form of our presidential candidate. It's loud and it should be clear. Yet a small enclave of career politicians within our party, this is Perdue, is still struggling to understand the mass appeal of Donald Trump. He says that for too long, career politicians have overpromised, they've underdelivered. And he goes on and talks about how he was an outside businessman running for office. He defeated the establishment in Jack Kingston and a couple of others in the primary campaign. And he's all on Donald Trump's campaign now. He's ready to go.
He's ready to go. I first heard about this about a month ago when I asked a few Republican insiders, why in the world is David Perdue not supporting the nominee for judge, Dax Lopez, that he, in fact, his committee recommended. And he seems to have double-crossed that Dax Lopez and, of course, threw him to the wolves. And several Republican insiders told me that he could not recommend an Hispanic for a judgeship because he thought it would hurt him with Trump because Trump had him under consideration for vice president. Now, these Republicans were the ones that told me about it, and this is very much consistent with the fact that he considers himself a viable candidate for vice president.
Brian, I don't, you know, David Perdue is so new to the United States Senate that he hasn't really become a player in national politics at this point. But he has, ever since getting there, continued the same theme that he used during the campaign. He's the outsider. Washington insiders are tone deaf. They're running up the deficit. We need a change. Is David Perdue positioning himself as the kind of outsider who is, as he continues his service there, going to find himself increasingly disliked by his Republican caucus up there? Or do you think they're going to start coming over to his way of thinking?
I think the way you keep the peace in Washington is not doing the things that Ted Cruz does, where you just blow things up for the sake of blowing them up to please a certain constituency. David Perdue has not shown at this juncture a tendency to do that, to do the things that just make everyone else angry. I do wonder how the relationship between him and Isaacson will evolve because, as Buddy mentioned with the Lopez thing, they've been on separate sides of the issues on numerous occasions, and they felt like
far more so than with Saxby and Isaacson,
who were just twins almost in voting record, and Isaacson sort of gets left out on taking the harder stands in Georgia from time to time. I found this op-ed to be significant on several levels. One, what is David Perdue angling for? Is it a cabinet position in the Trump administration? That's certainly what this sounds like. Is it consideration for vice president? Is it trying to get the support of the people of the Trump base so that he can run for president in 2020 if Trump loses? All of those things seem to be at play here. I would have gone about this slightly different. The first thing they did right was to take that outsider message and say, look, this was my message before it was Donald Trump's. He's on my bandwagon, essentially. I'm the one who started this whole, I'm a businessman, I created jobs, I'm an outsider, I'm going to blow the place up. But what I disagree is he says, throw out the old GOP talking points and start over, not be committed to ideology. When David Perdue ran a very traditional Republican campaign in 2014, he didn't say Planned Parenthood was okay. He didn't say trade is bad for American workers and we need tariffs. He didn't show openness to raising taxes on upper-income people. All of these things that Trump has done. I don't know what Perdue means when throwing out that ideological playbook because that's not what he did.
Right. I will tell you what. We seem to have two different kinds of Republicans right now. We have those who think that Trump has actually changed the playbook, and we have the rest who think that Trump is only renting the GOP right now, and that they will be moving to preserve it after he's moved on. But I think with this op-ed piece, you've got to put David Perdue in the former camp, that he thinks something fundamental has changed. When you were saying that you have beaten the preachy pundits and the ideological police, that's not just going against the press. That's going against your base.
Aaron?
Yeah, I do think that if we end up with a President Trump, you'll see more people moving to David Perdue's side of that thing because it's going to be the theme coming out of the White House.
Yeah, let me real quick ask you this conversation about him as a potential VP candidate. When I look at it, if Trump really is looking, as he has said on a number of occasions, for somebody who knows how Washington works to balance him off in that respect, Perdue doesn't offer him much of that. He's another businessman who became a senator. Fine. He's an example of how that can happen. But he doesn't strike me as a guy who brings the kind of experience Trump has claimed on several occasions to want.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think he would go in a different direction like Bob Corker, like we talked about before. But at the end of the day, if Trump supporters are supporting Trump because he's not Bob Corker, he's not an insider, an establishment person, they may just get more ginned up by an idea of a David Perdue or something.
Buddy
like
Darden,
that.
Because you and Roy Barnes are the last two remaining Democrats in Cobb County, I want to give you the last word before the break. I know that's not true. Don't tweet me.
he and I had dinner last night and talked about the very same thing, except to say one quick point. I've talked to two different Democratic senators who have been coming through Georgia raising money and so forth. And both of them, though, like Perdue, even though they don't go along with his ideology, they say at least he's courteous, he's kind, he's respectful of other people's opinions. So that will bide him well in the Senate, as opposed to Cruz, who is just a pariah.
Yeah, he's certainly not a bomb thrower and never will be. That's just not his style. All right, look, it's 2:26. We've talked longer than we should have before taking our first break. So let's do that very quickly right now. Come back. We still got an awful lot to talk about.
The new film comedy Pop Star is about a hip-hop group whose frontman, played by Andy Samberg, goes solo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Samberg and the film's directors, co-writers, and co-stars, Yorma Taconi and Akiva Schaffer. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. At the table, great group of insiders today. Former Congressman Buddy Darden, Brian Robinson, former Communications Director, Deputy Chief of Staff to Governor Nathan Deal, Aaron Gould Shinen, political reporter at the AJC, Jim Galloway, the political writer at the AJC. Aaron, let me turn to you, if I may. We've got some interesting runoffs coming up. We had a brief discussion on the show last week, and I'm not sure maybe you can help us understand this. Before we even talk about specific races, we have this eternity between the primary election, right, May 24th, and the July 26th runoff. How did that happen?
A couple of years ago, the Justice Department had sued the state because they claimed that there wasn't enough time between the primary and the runoff for overseas ballots and military ballots to get back to the state,
right,
to vote in the primary.
Which is why the runoff time is to allow for that. Okay,
correct.
Thank you. I get that now.
You brought it up. I'm terribly curious why this isn't a problem in other states, frankly, but that's beside
I'll tell
the
you
point.
Why. I'll tell you why. This all happened because the Obama administration wants Democrats to have a chance to win in Georgia, and so they want to make runoffs so cumbersome and so terrible for the state and for incumbents that they throw out runoffs and let it be a plurality winner, mm-hmm, because in a divided three-way race, a Democrat might have a shot in Georgia. That is why they targeted us. It is all a partisan ploy by the Obama administration.
Isn't that a general
except
election
to say this, except to say this, the state cut a bad deal. I think this was all an agreement, by the way, that the state reached with the federal judge. This was not an order per se, and I think the state didn't cut a very good deal here because it's not a problem in Mississippi. It's not a problem in Alabama or South Carolina. So it can't be just being singled out by the Obama administration.
Back to your original point. Go ahead.
Well, my question, let's look at a couple of the races. You've spent a lot of time covering congressional races, and you've now got one in the 3rd Congressional District, the open seat. Lynn Westmoreland, of course, retiring, we've said before on this show, perhaps to run for governor in 2018. We've got Mike Crane against Drew Ferguson, and it appears, you talk about this in the way you want to, but it appears that Ferguson is going to take advantage of this rather startling comment that Crane made about if everybody tries to serve a no-knock warrant at his house, he'll shoot to kill the cop who comes in the door.
In fact, yeah, Ferguson even the other day, I think on Friday, announced that if elected, he would try to make the murders of police officers a hate crime. Call it the Thin Blue Line Act or something like that. And while he didn't draw the connection directly to Crane's comments, obviously that's what the context there is. It was a bold sort of strike, I think, in an early part of the runoff. But today we reported that the other four candidates, minus Jim Pace, who was the third place finisher, the other four candidates, none of whom got more than 10% in the primary, but they've all endorsed Ferguson. We haven't heard from Jim Pace yet, but the money is probably on him also endorsing Ferguson.
Why are they all going to Ferguson?
I think because they don't like Crane.
They just don't like Crane.
It's my guess. I mean, okay. Crane is
nobody likes Crane.
That was Brian Robinson saying nobody likes Crane. That wasn't the objective reporter Aaron Goldshine.
It's a pretty common sentiment at the state capitol.
You had a horse in that race, though. We should.
But I don't anymore.
I understand. But for transparency, you did.
I did.
Right. But what it is Crane is seen by many people in the Capitol as kind of a no, he would be a no congressman, similar to Paul Brown.
Yeah.
And that is something you have very specific forces in the Georgia business community who are trying to block that.
So do we think that, Aaron, that if these guys really can bring their voters over, that Ferguson wins this runoff?
Well, if you add up the four other challengers that endorsed today and their totals to Ferguson's total, he gets over 50%. But, of course, it's a runoff in July, late July. Who knows who's going to turn back out for that? But I do think it's significant that the third district is Crane. You know, that mindset is not unusual. I mean, it was the third district Republican Party that voted to censure Governor Deal over his veto over the Religious Liberty Bill. So, you know,
it's a very conservative district. But will it make any difference whether it's Drew Ferguson or Mike Crane in terms of the United States House?
Yes, it will make a difference because Drew Ferguson has a proven record of understanding how government works, working with his colleagues, and to achieve an end. And if you're going to be one in 435, the only way you can ever get anything done is working with other people.
Isn't this a perfect microcosm for this election cycle, though? You've got the guy Crane, who's disliked by a lot of people, fervently liked by a lot of people, versus a very mild-mannered businessman background in Drew Ferguson. I think it's going to be a really interesting runoff.
So, Brian, we have you in the room. Jim Pace, your candidate in that race. He came so close, didn't he? The vote
it was razor thin.
Razor thin.
Yeah, the margin even between the two top vote getters is razor thin, and then third place was tight too.
So share with us what you're talking to him about in terms of endorsing in this race, Brian. Should he get behind Drew Ferguson? Are you encouraging him to do that? Will it be a good thing for Jim Pace to do that?
I have not encouraged him to do anything. I think that he should, and I hope that he does, because it matches more with what Jim Pace was running on. Pace was not running on a burn the place to the ground platform. It was a get things done for the people platform, which is very different than what you're hearing from some forces within the party that just want you to vote no on everything. You know, Lynn Westmoreland, importantly, has come out and said, we don't need another vote no on everything congressman. So that is as close to endorsement as you can get, and I think eventually you'll see him come out in favor of Drew totally. Now, I think, going to Aaron's point, summer runoff, your most ideologically rabid voters are the most dependable. That is advantage Crane. You've got Club for Growth that's going to spend $250,000, which is advantage Crane. But I do think that there's going to be some blowback on some of the just vote no. I think you can even see it in the Collins and Loudermilk races that they were seen as not pure enough, which is crazy. I mean, just absolutely crazy. And they managed to win by a big margin. Yeah. So I do think the pendulum is swinging, and I do think there's a group of Republicans out there nationally that's trying to stop new Freedom Caucus members. And they may come in and help Drew Ferguson.
Jim, if sovereign citizens would exercise the right to vote, I imagine Mike Crane would win that by big margin.
Yeah, but let me point something out. Drew Ferguson is the former mayor of West Point, and West Point is kind of adjacent to Kia, the Kia plant. You've got lots of employees there, mm-hmm. and that's a huge business connection for West Georgia right there.
Hey, his father was the single most important factor and person in bringing Kia to West Point, Georgia. So I think his father, Drew Ferguson, who was a retired banker down there, they've got good connections throughout the district. And I think they need another Lynn Westmoreland. And I think the closest thing you can come to that would be a Drew Ferguson.
All right, let's go to another race. And Jim, let me start with you because we're talking your home county. You've got a runoff between Tim Lee and his opponent.
Michael Boyce. You're going to get me in trouble here.
Who's he running against? Who's his runoff opponent? I know.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. This is so embarrassing. He is running off against Mike Boyce.
Mike Boyce, yes. Yes, yes.
I don't vote in Cobb County, Mike.
Okay, here's the thing. I have and I'm going to have to confess to being a little bit wrong on that. I think I had presumed that I've lived in Cobb County for far more than 30 years. It's a place with a chip on its shoulder when it comes to Atlanta, and it always wants to get something on Atlanta. They got the Braves. I thought that truly was going to protect Tim Lee, no matter what the secrecy involved in that. I think I was probably wrong.
You were wrong, but let me point this out to you. I still think a majority of the people in Cobb still support the Braves and are coming here. However, we had an abysmally low turnout here, and the Againers always come out, even in the hailstorm. People come out to vote against something and against somebody, and I don't think there's that much dissatisfaction with Tim Lee throughout the entire population, but if you look at the sample that showed up, it looks pretty bad for him.
So, Aaron, are you watching that race at all? What do you think is going to happen?
I'm just watching it from afar and sort of was watching in the newsroom on primary night. A lot of people gathered around the computer trying to refresh those results to see if Boyce would get up there to 50% or not. It was awfully close.
Yeah. It was Boyce got 49 plus. Tim Lee got 40.5 or 40.4 of the vote. And generally, the rule of thumb is that If you're kind of in that 47 to 48, 49% range and you're in a runoff, you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
Tim Lee is going to have to completely reshape the electorate.
So, Brian,
on July 26th.
I'm sorry.
That's hard.
Jim, I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Brian, I've suggested that this race has interest across the state. I mean, certainly the Braves Stadium is of interest to people across the state. But I've also wondered if it's of interest because it could be a referendum on open government. And by that, I mean, can you separate the Braves backroom deal, which Tim Lee engineered, and the money that's involved in that from a real desire on the part of residents, voters in Cobb County to make a statement about preferring open government? Because that's not the only time that they've cut deals without public input.
Let me say, to start off with, I have been retained by Tim Lee. So,
all right. Buddy, what do you think?
I think that Tim Lee should have retained Brian at the beginning of this campaign rather than right now.
I think one of the most important messages that needs to be driven throughout the entirety of this runoff is pushback on this narrative that has been pushed so hard by my good friends at the Journal Constitution. I mean, it is every day a new.
It has been
piece.
A crusade.
It's been a crusade against Tim Lee.
But not necessarily a crusade without substance and merit. But there's no question they have invested.
But the crux of the crusade is that when this deal was cut, there was a promise that only a certain amount of tax dollars would be employed to lure the Braves. And what the AJC has found is that it's a good deal more than that. I think that's a legitimate grounds for reporting.
Well, I hope I didn't miss. I did say there's substance there.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the idea that there were no public hearings, that no one got to have their say on it, is simply not true. And that keeps getting repeated over and over again. This was handled the way that any big economic development deal is handled. You know, you negotiate privately, which is exactly what we did with Caterpillar, what we did with Baxter, what we did with Kia. And then there comes a point where it has to go public and the public gets their say. That is what happened in this situation. The public got their say. And in a open vote in front of Cobb County, a majority
over Thanksgiving holiday,
a majority of the commission voted yes. And if you poll Cobb County Republicans, most of them are happy the Braves are coming. And I think that is the bottom line. The final product, Cobb Republicans and a majority of people in the county, and Democrats included, are for the deal as it ended up.
All right. Well, to put a final note on the Braves, I did think it was interesting that Bill Campbell, the former mayor of Atlanta, hasn't given an interview since coming out of prison that I'm aware of, at least not to television. He did the other day, and he called the Braves deal
blasphemous.
Blasphemous.
Blasphemous. And yes, I think Bill Campbell's opinion will matter a great deal on the other side of the chat.
It's the last thing we were waiting for.
All right. Before we take a break, I want to address one more issue, because when we come back, we're going to talk about the transgender issue at roiling the state. And Jenny Ahmed has been out at the Silver Skillet gathering sound from the Silver Skillet Salon on this issue. But let's talk just briefly. Jim, you reported, or Political Insider did, that Nathan Deal, as many of us suspected, is going to stay as far away from Augusta and the state convention as he can.
Right.
Why?
Well, he's got those two vetoes that he's likely to get some blowback from, and you're likely to see the state GOP convention pass a few resolutions.
Which is this weekend,
right.
I should have said.
It's Friday and Saturday. House Speaker David Ralston also is not going. He's giving it a miss. And I think this is important for this reason. For the last, since 2002, when Republicans took control of the state, it's been the job of the Georgia governor at the GOP convention to remind the your most fervent Republicans that governance is involved here and that some restraint in rhetoric is called for. That's not going to be there on Friday. And that this is a very important meeting of the state GOP.
Yeah, so Brian, we do expect there will be some sort of resolution that the convention will be asked to vote on condemned, censure, not that there's a formal process in some way, your former boss on these two vetoes. But it's also curious that you have two of the most important Republicans in state politics saying they're not going. What does that say about the state of the Georgia Republican Party? Is it fractured?
The people who show up for the convention are some of your most hard right ideologues within the party. If you go around in a statewide election going to county party conventions and you're winning all the straw polls, you're probably going to lose the primary because the folks who show up on Saturday morning at IHOP to talk about politics in a group don't necessarily view the world the way that the rest of the Georgia Republican primary electorate does. And, you know, going back 10 years ago, Saxby Chambliss was getting booed at the state convention. Governor Deal, I have been there where he has been booed. David Ralston has been booed. And these are supposed to be your most loyal supporters. So there comes a point in time where it gets to be silly to even think they're going to show up. Why would they?
Is there any reason to think that at some point down the line, these the people who are booing the elected leaders, are going to in fact register that concern at the polls? In other words, is this going to have an impact on elections down
the line? We've been asking that question for a number of cycles now. We keep talking about when it was just the Tea Party, now it's the Trumpers and what have you, and we talked about it on the show before the primary in May. You know, were Barry Loudermilk and Doug Collins going to be in trouble because they had these anti-establishment outside types running against them in the age of Trump? And the answer very clearly at the polls was no. We've been waiting for the Tea Party, hard right Republicans in the state to rise up and kick somebody out of office since 2008, if not 2010, and it really just hasn't happened.
One thing that you've come to see on a regular basis at these Georgia Republican conventions is a push to make the convention the sole determiner of who its candidates are. It hasn't gotten anywhere, but that's where they're trying to push
it. That would be a fascinating development. Real quick, buddy.
There's always going to be tension between the elected officials and the party because the elected officials have the responsibility of governing and making decisions that apply to everyone for everyone's good. And, of course, the people who are in the parties, and this is Democratic as well as Republican, are just that event.
Okay.
And really have nothing else to do.
Okay, Jenny Ahmed has her finger on the break button. We have got to get our second break of the show in. Let's do it right now, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut, Jim Galloway, Aaron Gould-Chinen, Brian Robinson, Buddy Darden at the table today. Five veterans, four veterans and me of Georgia politics. So we want to talk a bit about this, the lawsuit that Georgia has now joined. 11 states are suing the federal government after the Obama rule, which said that schools across the country, public schools, I always have trouble with this one. They're not transgender bathrooms, they're boys' rooms and girls' rooms, but the school should allow a student to go to the bathroom that is the same sex they identify with, essentially.
Exactly. Rather than their sexual identity on their birth certificate.
So, yes, we're going to talk about that lawsuit, why Georgia is in it, in a moment. But as I said before the break, Jenny has been out doing another one of her Man on the Street Vox pieces. She was at the Silver Skillet right down the street from us here. So let's hear from the people who were dining at the Silver Skillet political salon just the other day.
Oh, like the whole transgender thing?
I think we just need to go by what's on our driver's license.
They're not going to station someone at the bathroom to try and decide who gets to go in, sorry, and who doesn't. And they shouldn't.
It's important to be fair to everyone, but at the same time, everyone includes the majority too, not just the minority.
It's a tough question.
You know, it's just ridiculous that people should be separated out that way.
It's a tough question.
It's already proven to be dangerous for females.
I think it's much ado about nothing. If each side would leave the other side alone, there would be no problem.
There are some issues concerning safety of individuals, especially females.
We find unisex bathrooms everywhere, so that's the approach we take.
But this is a plumbing question. Girls' plumbing and boys' plumbing is different.
You know, people don't often put themselves in other people's shoes, so it's like if you were in that situation, you would want your own freedom.
But now, all of a sudden, the president is saying that sex and gender are the same. How does he have the right to do that?
If, say, a pedophile says that he's transgender and he goes in the women's restroom, you know, then he's in there with little girls or vice versa, you know, they're in there with little boys. So it could be dangerous. They're in there waiting for them.
And a lot of people, they're trying to, like, justify by saying, oh, I want my children to be safe. I want my children to be protected. But what's the issue? You know what I mean? Like, it's nobody's going to bother them.
The guy that walks into the bathroom with my daughter is not going to walk out in one piece.
However you were born, that's where you should go.
And what's your reasoning behind that?
The safety of my children.
For me personally, coming from the Middle East, there's a lot bigger issues to worry about in this world than, you know, where people go to the restroom.
I think it just gets really tricky for a person dressed as a woman to walk into a men's room, for a person dressed as a man to walk into the women's room.
That's just my opinion.
But that's my opinion.
That's my opinion.
My name is Erlene Jones.
Carrie Vade.
I'm Augustine Vargas.
Tony Creasy.
Rob O'Satin.
Robert J.
Ramin Mahagagi.
My name is Bill. Last name is Schreckenstein. I would spell it, but it takes too long.
Scott. Last name Bear.
Peter Lancaster.
Sandra Valentine. Don't be another sequel.
There you go. Voices like yours out there, gathered by Jenny Ament, our terrific producer here on Political Rewind. Okay, so we know those voices do reflect what we're all hearing every day out there. But Jim, why has Georgia decided it has to be in this lawsuit?
It's decided that it wants to be in this lawsuit. Originally, you had Attorney General Sam Mullins and I think Governor Nathan Deal saying that they doubted that the state could have standing in such a lawsuit because this was a letter of significant guidance from the White House. It wasn't a directive. It wasn't a mandate.
No, but it came but with you, the potential for came, a loss of federal funds.
Exactly, with the potential, but it wasn't an actual directive. But you've had Sam Mullins says he's done some research and he says yes, we can have standing. I think that's going to be the key argument in this thing.
Let me make this observation as a Democrat and who's just gone through this latest legislative session and seen what's happened there. I think we ought to give Governor Deal a pass on this one because after he did two courageous things in vetoing those two bills of religious freedom and campus carry, let him go ahead and do this because this is not going to hurt anybody.
Well,
it's harmless.
Buddy, you're very...
It's harmless, and it has no meaning anyway. If he needs to play his politics, give him a chance. Give him a break.
Okay, let me suggest this. Not that it's lovely of you, the Democrat, to want to give the governor a break. I'm not about whether he should be in the suit or not. Brian, it is certainly also true that the state will, in fact, spend some of our money on this lawsuit, right?
I think Sam Mullins is doing the exact right thing by doing this, and I appreciate how he and the governor have addressed it. They're not talking about transgender children who are facing a really tough situation and whose parents are facing an unimaginable dilemma of your child who's being bullied, who is depressed, whose suicide rates are through the roof. I mean, those are really, really tough, heartbreaking issues. And Deal and Owens aren't aren't demonizing those children or their parents. What they're saying is the Obama administration, once again, has overreached the constitutional limits of executive power, holding a sword over states' heads to push progressive ideas and pounding them if you don't fall in the line.
In a way, you could say this is kind of a halfway step, because when this letter first came down, you had religious conservatives in Georgia demanding that the governor join the North Carolina lawsuit, the defense of the HB2 law over there, which specifically addresses the bathroom issues. They did not. They joined this other Texas-oriented lawsuit.
All right. So, Aaron, as you read the stories from students and parents in individual schools, now transgender students, it is, as Brian says, heartbreaking, because suddenly an awfully bright light has been shined upon them. And I do think, and we've talked about this briefly on the show before, we have to ask whether the Obama administration, whether it's actual overreach or not, whether this just is not yet an idea whose time has come. And the question is, why did they decide they had to force this issue now?
I don't know. I think that's a really good question, because I don't know sure that they needed to do it. I mean, if you read the original stories, this first flared up in Georgia a couple weeks ago with Fannin County, if you remember, right? And I saw an interview with a superintendent there who said, we've been following this policy. We already have a policy on how to handle children who are transgendered to get them access to the bathroom.
Done quietly,
yeah. With nobody knew. And it's been going on for years, he said. Yeah. And they had guidelines on how to do it. And then suddenly the Obama administration gets involved and it just blows up like
this. It really does seem to be, Brian, pushing public opinion in a direction that people may eventually come to as they have gay marriage, but aren't quite ready to deal with at this point.
It was really bad timing, and one of the first things I thought when this came out was, I bet the Hillary Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn is explosive with anger, and if any high-ranking Obama administration officials go missing, you need to start looking for suspects in Brooklyn.
You know, that's a great point, buddy.
Let's get
this doesn't help Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. I'm sure Hillary wasn't in favor of doing this, but I was with Sam Olens the night before they made the announcement the following day that they were going to do that. I don't even think that was on his radar for sure at that time. But I think after consulting with the governor that, hey, what's wrong with some pushback here? Because, listen, we spend a lot of money on a lot of other lawsuits, and all you got to do is join in on this one and file a few briefs. So it's not going to cost any money, and I don't see any great amount of harm being done.
Amen, buddy.
And don't forget, I have no idea what's in Sam Olens' mind or what drove him to do this, but if he's going to be a statewide candidate in 2018 in Georgia and he refused to join this lawsuit, I think pretty sure that would come up in a primary.
Very interesting. All right. We've only got a few minutes left. I said that the will of the listeners would prevail as to whether we would play Donald Trump's statements at his news conference about the media yesterday. Nobody wants to hear them again. That doesn't mean they don't love Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump. It's just they've heard him. You've all heard these comments over and over. But, Jim, I think it is fair to ask. Trump probably went further yesterday, as a couple of reporters at their own peril mentioned to him, in terms of demonizing the media, primarily over the Trump University story. And yeah. So for those, we have three basic journalists here and two people involved in the political sphere. I continue to have this terrible problem with understanding how you address these issues, how you address that kind of approach he's taken without just giving him more attention.
And that's the question. I look, you know, this is he is probably the most unvetted presidential candidate we have had, at least in my lifetime. In that you can't get direct answers from him. When he gives a direct answer, they change. I mean, he changes in the same paragraph. And you know, I will tell you what, I watched that press conference, and the scariest thing in there was you had, I think, somebody from ABC ask him, is this what it's going to be like under a President Trump?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah.
Brian,
yeah.
What do you do with that? I mean, you've been a communications director for a governor. Do you try to talk to Trump about needing to have somewhat more amicable relations? I mean, the questions yesterday were not, awful. They wonder, what's the deal? First, the real questions were about, his $6 million claim to veterans groups. I apologize. I got that wrong at the beginning. Oh, he has, in fact, it turns out, given all that money. He may not have given it until the questions started being raised. But can you really... Is alienating the media and poisoning the well so that the are you vaccinating yourself? Are you inoculating yourself for the general election campaign by doing this?
But what my thing is, what else can the media do to the guy? You know, I get up in the morning and I look at what the AJC has to say, and they don't cover the ins and outs of the national campaign as much as they focus on local stuff. But in the Washington Post and the New York Times, every day it is not unusual to look at the op-ed pages of those two publications, and four of the five op-eds are attacks on Donald Trump.
Well, wait, Aaron, I would argue that a Clinton supporter, Buddy Darden, might say the same thing about the stories he's reading in the New York Times.
Oh, we've been pilloried. We've been pilloried for 30 years, and now just because it gets a little hot for him, he makes these unseemly, and I think they're all unseemly, comments to the media.
A pilloried Hillary.
Telling people that they are sleaze, telling people that they are liars and whatever. That is not, I don't think, fitting of a presidential candidate.
But, as a journalist who's been called many names by many different politicians,
And by communications director.
Brian Robinson wasn't exactly the media's best friend.
Well, we always got along, but except when we couldn't. But, I just don't think it's news. I'm sorry. I get frustrated by my colleagues in the National Press Corps who I think hope that he calls them names so that they can then go on Twitter and Facebook and puff their chests up and say, look at me. I just think it's necessary. Attacking the news media does not news make. And I wish we'd just find a different way to do this.
All right. We are out of time. We will certainly continue to cover the Trump campaign, as we will Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and David French, Bill Kristol's new candidate for
join the
President
Revolution
of the United States. We'll have time. We'll have time to talk about David French on a show on Friday. We'll also talk about Bill Kristol, who, of course, gave us Sarah Palin, and Dan Quayle. So this is a guy with a great track record, and we'll talk about that. In the meantime, I want to thank Jim Galloway, Aaron Gould-Shinen, Buddy Darden, Brian Robinson for being here. Before we leave you, right now we just happen to be doing a number of programs over at the Carter Presidential Library. We did Andy Young the other night. That'll be on the air on Saturday and Sunday on Two-Way Street. But I do think you need to know about a show we're doing a week from tomorrow, the 9th, with Sebastian Younger. He, as you know, came on the scene with a mega hit, his book on the fishing boat disaster that was turned into a giant movie, the title of which is escaping me right now. But he's got a new book on what happens to veterans when they come back and are not accepted in the community the way they deserve to be. We're going to talk about it at the Carter Library. This is a ticketed event, so you're going to have to go to Acapella Books to get tickets, but we'd love to see you there. That's it for us. See you again on Friday at 3. I can't believe-